Tuesday, the 9th of January. And that night, I note, was a grand reception for all the Americans in Peking at the Great Hall given by the Chinese People's Friendship Association with Foreign Countries. Wang Bingnan hosted that, and he came out of hospital to come to the meeting. He'd been in the hospital for some weeks and went back to the hospital after the reception, and which was a further mark of the close relationship that we had at that time.
His connection with the United States, of course, was intimate, not only at Warsaw, but going back to the Yan'an period. And he had gotten to know John Service very well at
yes.
that time. So he's always been thought of as one of our friends.
Yeah, when I said the obvious things, well, Mr. Chairman, you we are honored, but you didn't have to put yourself out to this extent. Oh, for my American friends, I would do anything, as my memory of what he said. Then I went with the on to Tokyo with Kodal Nun immediately following that, because I needed to go back for some dental work, but was back in Peking very quickly. And I know that on the 15th of January, there's a big group came from UCLA. The University of Pittsburgh was the first university to come to try and enlarge upon the educational opportunity. They were there before normalization, the first one after normalization, obviously arranged without regard to normalization, was the UCLA group, and were pushing hard to try and establish a relationship. And then the rush of businessmen continued. I see Caltech, Standard of California, Bell Helicopter.
Bell Helicopter being the first indication that beyond the horizon lay a military relationship, too. They were not there to sell military helicopters.
They were there to sell commercial helicopters that obviously easily adaptable to
that's right.
to commercial to military purposes. Then on the 18th of January, I went to the United States to get ready for the state visit by Deng Xiaoping. Got in Washington on Friday and was on the was on Meet the Press on Sunday the 21st. My interviewers were Joe Kraft and Bob Novak and Tom Brokaw. Joe Kraft really went after me on the business of endangering salt, and he was particularly pushing me on the business of being even-handed. The one specific instruction I had was to say that our policy was to be even-handed as between China and the Soviet Union.
Who gave you that instruction?
The secretary.
Uh-huh.
And so I dutifully, when that came up, gave this answer. When we were off the air, Joe Kraft came up to me and he said, Leonard, you don't really believe that bullshit you were telling me, do you? I'll never forget that. I said, frankly, I don't.
Now, you, what was, this was the first meeting you had with Tsai since normalization. What did he tell you?
I met with him the day before on Saturday. He said he was gratified with what had happened. He was not gushing with enthusiasm by any means. And it had mostly to do with Meet the Press, and, well, not a great, we weren't there very long, maybe 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Holbrook was with me.
And it was the first time you'd seen Dick since normalization, too.
Yes. Well, I'd seen him, of course, before the meeting with the secretary.
Uh-huh.
I'd seen him earlier that day.
Earlier that day.
went over the briefing book. The briefing book was for Meet the Press, which I newly read. Those briefing books, you know, I used to get them for testimony on the Hill. I suppose they were useful, but they tended to maybe concentrate, bring back to your memory certain odd things, but they were always made up as though you could follow these things sequentially, which is not what happens, certainly not on Capitol Hill. But the Meet the Press went very well. And then following that, I began to my tour of the president of the senators, particularly on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I met with Alan Cranston, along with Dick Holbrooke and Bader. What was Bader's first name?
Bill Bader.
The State Department. A young.
He had been up on the Hill before.
Yes, he was.
I think his name was Bill Bader.
He was the congressional liaison who was to guide the effort with regard to the Taiwan Relations Act, not called that at that point, of course. And he. I accompanied him, or he was with me when I testified.
No, Jeff, maybe.
Jeff Bader,
who is now in Peking. Jeff Bader.
Very conscientious, young,
right.
Bright Foreign Service
That's
officer.
Jeff Bader, who is now in Peking.
But I was amazed at how passive the process was as far as Capitol Hill was concerned. It was just a question of going to these meetings and listening to what was going on. It was purely passive. I saw no evidence of any attempt to guide. Now, you can't guide openly. You certainly know the people who are sympathetic and through whom one can work. And Alan Cranston, of course, was such a person. Next one I saw was Adlai Stevenson. Well, we quickly dismissed China and my getting approved. That was no problem. Then spent better part of an hour philosophizing about his frustrations with the Senate and with public life in general, which he must have reconciled since he's now running for governor of Illinois. Then Claiborne Pell.
Now Stevenson, though, and if I come back to Stevenson for a minute, Stevenson was not enthusiastic about normalization. He was critical about timing.
Yes.
And its impact on the Soviet Union. He's always particularly concerned about the SALT process and stabilizing our SALT our Soviet relationship.
That is true, but he didn't argue that with me because I said I didn't share that view, so he just set that aside.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly, as I say, a philosophic discussion. Then Claiborne Pell. And Senator Pell was always insisting the Taiwanese were different. Every time I met with him, I had to say, they're politically different, but they're not ethnically different. And there are many basic things that tend to unite them.
Quite right. Pell was basically a Taiwan independence person.
Yes,
and
but this was his justification.
That's right. But he basically, Taiwan independence had to be managed extremely carefully. Also, I thought, not a terribly bright man.
Well, I wouldn't argue that point. Then next was Hayakawa. And that was, he had then, and they still have, an elderly man who was his foreign affairs advisor. I forget his name. He had told me before I went in to see the senator, there's no problem in the senator voting for your confirmation. And I said, well, it's more than that. I'm also concerned about his attitude and on the new relationship. When I went in to see him, all he wanted to talk about was his days as a graduate student at the University of Michigan when he was a radical. Did I know that? And I said, yes, I'd known that. I'd said, of course.
I didn't know that. He's a Michigan graduate?
He was a graduate student. Whether he took his doctorate here or not, I don't know. But he was a graduate student at Michigan. I had congratulated him on what he did when he was president at San Francisco State, because I think he helped diffuse some of the nonsense that was going on. But we didn't talk very much about China. Then Dick Lugar, senator from Indiana, former mayor of Indianapolis, with whom I had a fairly good relationship.
Bright man.
Yes.
Very and
conscientious.
And supportive of normalization,
yes,
by and large, wasn't he? He has
supportive in a critical way.
Yeah.
Supportive, yes.
Yeah, but I think he has a basic strategic sense of China's role in the world.
I would agree with that, yes, definitely. And in my confirmation hearings, he was very helpful. Then Jesse Helms.
Was John Carbo there?
He was, and two other
Son
staff,
of a bitch.
Two or three other staff members. And the senator's role was to sit by benignly and let the staff, particularly Carbo, go after me. I think I held my own, and lasted quite a long time.
Have I told you my Carbo story?
No.
In the summer, I'll interrupt, but it's an interesting one. Carbo came up to see me when Zbig got back from China. And my instructions were, standing instructions, NSC staff member, was to see every staff person who came, who wanted to see me. So Carbo came up, and he came in, and the first thing he said is, Senator Helms would like to meet you. So I thought, my gosh, what is this all about? He said, I might as well get straight to the point. Senator Helms is for normalization. As long as he can be convinced that the security of Taiwan can be taken care of and that we behave in an honorable fashion toward Taiwan. So I said, well, I'm just delighted to hear that. I sent a euphoric note to Zbig that night, you know, about that little conversation. Then he said he'd like a debriefing on Zbig's trip. And I gave him one, and then he said, no, and then he said, before I gave him the debriefing, he said, but I want you to know this, Senator Helms wants to know what the best case is that can be made for normalization to conservatives so that he can carry that forward, understand the argument. So I said, well, I want you to, and then he said one other thing, he said, I want you to know too, Senator Helms knows that you have all the cards. You can normalize whenever you want. And I thought that was a very interesting admission on his part. I felt that way, but I said, I didn't even acknowledge it, but he said, you have all the cards, and we know that. And I must say, I was very gullible. I didn't know who I was dealing with at all. He then said, give me the arguments. And I said, I don't necessarily agree with all the arguments I'm going to give you, but I'll tell you how I would defend normalization as a conservative, very strongly anti-Soviet, etc., etc. And as to Taiwan, that I believed in patriotism, we shouldn't allow our government to be penetrated by any foreign countries. We had to act on our own interests. I'm very tough-minded. Well, I gave him that whole argument. And he left. Then he came back about a month later, and I said, where's Senator Helms? He said, he wants to meet you, but he just want to keep on the conversation and all. And we went over some of the same ground of what our China policy was. He came back in September, and I remember the date clearly because I checked my record later, make sure I hadn't lied to him. Came back in September, and I said, well, I'm eager to meet Senator Helms, and he said he's busy, and I began to think that this was a scam operation. And at that time, he was very strange in his behavior. He said, are you sure this office isn't bugged in the NSC building? And I began to think, you really must think I'm a piker, he said, because I want to talk to you about some top secret material that I know because I have contacts with the Defense Department on. I thought, well, I'm just going to stop being played along by this shark. And I'm telling you this. So then Carbo came up the third time, and I decided it was time to button down this operation. I'd also gotten a warning from Madeleine Albright, who handled congressional relations for the NSC staff, that Carbo had really used an NSC staffer on Africa policy, and to be very cautious and careful. So I had gone into this third conversation with him, forewarned. But this time he turned to normalization and began to feel me out as to when normalization was going to occur, whether we were negotiating it, and I just obviously had to deadpan it. And I walked him out to the gate, the southwest gate on Executive Avenue, and just as we got to the gate, I asked him about his personal activities. He told me he drank, that he was a bon vivant, he liked to drink wine, all that. I said, oh, call me sometime, we'll go out to dinner, something like that. I'd like to get to know you better. And then as we got to the gate, very jovial type, but totally wary conversation between two adversaries, turned to me, said, let me just ask you one question. There is a rumor that you are going to normalize relations with China on February 28th. Is that true?
So the anniversary of the Shanghai Communique.
And so I said, yeah, why? I looked at him. Tell me why February 28th, when he said anniversary of Shanghai Communique. I said, oh, I literally had forgotten the date. I said, oh.
There was a lot of speculation about that, by the way.
I said, that is just absolutely, I can assure you, I said, that is, we have no plan with regard to that. I said, we have no sense of timing on normalization. Which was true in September. I mean, no, we hadn't progressed that far yet. I said, I can assure you that's not true at all. All of that, and we said goodbye. And then on normalization, he turned out he'd taken notes on all his conversations with me, and he revealed them. The debriefing of the Brzezinski trip and all, just to prove the treachery of NSC staff people in dealing with the Congress, and including the fact that I had alleged that we should support NETO in Angola and whoever in the Southern African situation, so we just had to deny it. But he said that I also, that he was convinced I was a liar because the formal date of normalization was March 1, and it showed his February 28th. Information was accurate.
Well, he was the point man, of course, in the session that I had in Senator Helms' office. And most of the ranged around the threat to Taiwan, which I think I held my own. Helms did not oppose my nomination as such when it came before the Foreign Relations Committee. If you remember, he was insisting no ambassador should be named until the Senate knew the scope of the relation, the scope of the legal relationship between Taiwan and the United States in the new circumstance. And of course, that was finally broken by Senator Burr, the majority leader, just laying down the law as to just what was going to happen. But I must say, Mr. Carbo justifies his reputation.
Terrible. He really is of the same tradition as Cohn and Shine in the McCarthy era.
He is. And it's amazing that he keeps his place so long. You'd think that he would get so tangled up in his own maneuvers that he'd completely wear out his usefulness.
Holdridge told me that he thought that Carbo is the person who leaked the arms sales to Taiwan story before Holdridge got to Peking. That they had in fact briefed Helms beforehand of what their decision was.
normal conduct, without question. Then I saw the next day, on Wednesday the 24th, saw Senator Jackson. I think I've said on this record that he and I had become reconciled in Peking, and we're again good friends. Then I went to see Bob Michael, the minority leader in the House, because I was not simply concerned with whether or not I'd be confirmed, but trying to have an understanding of just what was involved. And I must say that, and I saw later that same day, but he was not the minority leader, he was assistant minority leader, because I also saw John Rhodes of Ohio, who was then the minority leader. And I found them quite open-minded, and I had the feeling afterwards that these things were not pursued.
By the administration, you mean, in working on these people?
Yes, yes. And Don Riegel of Michigan.
Yeah, I think you're right. On congressional liaison, there the burden was states. And the state congressional liaison was this fellow Doug Bennett. And
right.
He was not really organized for a big push of this sort. I remember going over there. Madeleine Albright contributed, but I agree with you. The handling of Congress through this period was not effective.
See, I went to see Riegel simply because he was from Michigan. He was not on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Then went in to see Fritz Hollings, Senator Hollings. And he astounded me by saying, we shouldn't have anything to do with either one of them. We should get rid of that phony government in Taiwan and let the people in Taiwan make their own decisions. And I said, well, Senator, you surprised me by what you're saying. That isn't feasible at the moment. That government, no matter what one may think of it, is solidly in control. And he said, well, there's no problem as far as you're concerned. But I think I've known Fritz Hollings a long time. I think he loves the effect as much as anything, because when I laughed, he just laughed and said we should get rid of those phony nationalists.
That's fascinating, because I thought of him through his role in the Taiwan Relations Act and his role in the consultations requirement in the Goldwater case. I thought of him as strong pro-Taiwan.
He was pro-Taiwan, but
anti-KMT,
right? Then Senator Proxmire. Was Bill Proxmire on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee?
I think not.
I don't know.
But he was certainly going to be involved in the establishment of an economic relationship with China.
That's probably where I went to see him. And then Senator Zirinsky, the senator from Nebraska. The next morning, had breakfast along with Dick Holbrooke with Dick Stone, the senator from Florida. Very bright guy and very aggressive, and in this particular, very hard to corral.
Well, he had I think he did have close connections with Taiwan, but he was one of those who saw Taiwan as the Israel of the East too. You know, he was not reelected. He did not even get the Democratic nomination in 80.
Right.
And my understanding, he spent some time in Tallahassee after he moved up to Tallahassee from South Florida. My understanding is that an unspoken reason for erosion of Democratic Party support in Florida for him was a feeling that they'd have just elected a senator from Israel. And certainly not true for the Democratic Party of South Florida, shall we say, but it certainly
right.
is an issue in North Florida. He was the first Jewish senator from Florida, and I think Floridians began to feel it was a little bit too much so.
Of course, he was a surprise nominee in 1974.
That's right.
I know that the UAW at that time did not support him, supported him when he finally got the nomination, but did not support him in the primary, and we were surprised at his win. Then we had a meeting with, along with Dick Holbrooke, with Ambassador Chai. I would think that had to be about the strongest feeling that there was going to be the Chinese intervention in Vietnam. I think that's what that was about.
Even before, this was just on the eve of Deng's visit, and did he have a special message to convey to you? I don't remember did I attend that meeting?
My book says with Holbrooke et al. I don't think so. It may not have been about that. It may have been about and the fact that it was at the State Department. I would think it would not have been about that, because I think the ambassador asked for the meeting. Anyway, then Senator Sarbanes of Maryland and Warren Magnuson, and you're right, on Proxmire, because I'd be seeing Magnuson because of the economic problems that were going to come up. Then spent quite a bit of time with John Glenn, who, of course, was still very upset about the way it was done. And again, he said, look, there's no problem as far as you're concerned, but... And we had a long discussion about it.
Don't you think part of that is reflective also of John Glenn's personality, that he struck me in my brief encounters with him as a rather indecisive figure.
I'd say cautious rather than indecisive.
Extremely thorough.
Yeah, he weighs every possibility, but I think when he has to, he can make up his mind. But he takes his time. And on other issues, frequently his staff never could predict where he would come out, particularly if the staff was split on what should be done about some item.
Very much a centrist, too, I mean, in that sense. You get the sense he's always on close issues. He is at the center in the spectrum when there are close issues and where the balance between the two is close. He seems to somehow be in the center and weigh it. Wait, Helly, I agree with that.
Then I went to see Howard Baker because, again, this was in the same pattern of my seeing Rhodes and Michael. Mm-hmm. And here again I found an open-minded receptivity to what may need to be done with regard to the new problem.
Zbigh had worked on Baker.
Uh-huh.
Was there any sign when you met any of these Republicans that of Nixon's hand in behind the scenes?
Not that I was aware of. Then Charles Percy, of course, the UAW had a rather close relationship with Percy, and so had I. But on the question of Taiwan security, he took a much tougher position than I had expected. Not in that meeting, but, I mean, subsequently.
And Baker probably had, too.
Yes. My guess about Baker is that he would not have if it had not surfaced under someone else's leadership. And then Ted Kennedy. Then that night, Ted Kennedy had a stag dinner in his home for Ambassador Chai. Were you at that dinner?
Yes, I was.
My memory of it is there were, who was there? I think Cranston was there and other senators.
Stevenson, I think, maybe. Church, maybe?
Yeah, I think Frank Church was there. And there was some there were suggestions to Chai that they should begin to cultivate people on Capitol Hill so that the nationalists, the Kuomintang, certainly would be working the Hill very skillfully, and that they should get
Matthias, I think.
Mac Matthias, right.
There were some Republicans there also, as I recall.
Yes. Percy, I guess, was there.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It was a very good gathering. Again, you know, again, an indication of how the Carter administration did not handle Senator Kennedy well. Here was an issue of centrality to him. He had committed himself to normalization at an early stage in his senatorial career. And yet, while we were meeting with him that evening and he was doing groundwork for the administration, the White House was in a tizzy as to whether to invite him or not
to the dinner. Right.
And Dick Holbrooke and I just went time and time again to the invitation list to make sure Senator Kennedy got invited. And he was invited, but too late, because he already knew that he really wasn't wanted.
I remember that. Then I went to see Mike Blumenthal, of course, was Secretary of the Treasury, and to see Tip O'Neill, because for obvious reasons, I couldn't visit with Rhodes and Michael and not go see my old friend. I had to tell him what was going on. He, of course, was strongly supportive.
You haven't touched base yet with Clem Zablocki.
I had done that at an earlier time on the general question. I think there was some reason I tried during this period and we couldn't make connection.
Right.
Then I had lunch with Ed Muskie, who of course was completely supportive. And then saw Secretary Vance. This had to do with the upcoming visit. Because then later that afternoon, Ambassador Chai and his wife and Sharon and myself, and who else went? Did you go? No.
No, I stayed. God, we were working to the last minute.
Must have been someone else from state. And of course, Secret Service went along.
Maybe protocol, some people from protocol. Either Kit Dobell.
Kit
went out.
Kit was there. And we went to Seattle and then on to Anchorage. Got to Anchorage late on a Friday night and then went out at midnight on Saturday to Elmendorf Air Force Base to await Deng Xiaoping's plane arrival.
Let me stop you here on two things. First, you've met a number of senators. I think that you've given us an impression, but I want to make even more explicit what I sense you're indicating, that you had a very successful round of consultations with the Senate leadership on both sides of the aisle, that you also had that on the House side, but that you are implying, and that you're implying, the administration had fertile ground and really failed to make use of it and nurture it in preparation for the Taiwan Relations Act that lay ahead. Is that what was implicit in what you're saying here?
That was my impression, yes. Subsequent impression,
right.
Not impression at the time.
But in other words, you found favorable ground, but then nothing happened to it. Lay fallow.
The reactions I got were questioning, but they were not at all hostile. What hostility there was to the method, the way it was done, not to what was done. And a willingness to be convinced, but not going to convince themselves for the most part. Some, yes,
mm-hmm.
but not that many.
So a presidential cell job was in order.
Very definitely, the White House, certainly.
Interesting. Second, do you remember your conversation at all with Vance before going out to see Deng? What were his hopes for the trip, worries?
It's kind of bland in my memory. Obviously, there would have been some conversation about the Vietnam problem, because that was strongly in all our minds. But nothing apart from that particularly sticks out.
One of the things, you didn't look at state talking points that they sent over, did you?
We also talked, either in that session or the earlier session, about, in this session, I think, about SALT II. If I had been my rounds, I could say some things about SALT II. Which, of course, I was wasn't concluded at that point, but certainly was within reach, of which I was completely supportive.
Sure. One thing I have to ask others about, but I've never understood, namely why the State Department did not supply the president's talking points for his meeting with Deng Xiaoping until a day and a half before Deng arrived. Among the many, and did you see any circulating over there before you took off?
I don't think so.
You were, so in effect, you were making rounds on the Hill, so you did not get involved in the planning for the Deng visit or offer advice on what should be said to Deng and that kind of thing, huh?
No. If so, it was very incidental. Very incidental.
Is one of the, I ended up personally writing the entire briefing book for the president for Deng's visit. That was among, in addition to a lot of other things, I did the whole thing. We got one with 2 days to go, and it was too late. The president had already gone away. So I just wrote it, sent it up. But I wondered whether it was just busy or controversy, and they couldn't get it signed off by Vance as to what the president should actually say about China, about the Soviet Union, about MFN. You know, there were a whole range of very tough issues that did deal with even-handedness. And
if there were controversy, I was unaware of it.
Yeah, well, I was too. I thought maybe it was time. But then once I sent it up, they were angry that the NSC was usurping state's role.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. So, Deng Xiaoping's plane arrived in Anchorage at 2:30 Sunday morning, Alaska time, of course, and briefly on the ground for an hour. The Air Force Base commander had laid out a sumptuous spread with fresh salmon, and the Vice Premier looked in good shape despite his long haul across the Pacific. And then at 3:30 in the morning, we left and arrived at Andrews Air Force Base at 3:30 in the afternoon.
So you rode on the Chinese plane with him?
Rode on the Chinese plane.
Did he sleep?
We ate. When we got on, he went to his cabin. It wasn't gone very long, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. And he came out, and he was full of excitement. You just feel it. The adrenaline really must have been flowing. And we ate. at 3:30.
Now, this was really one of the first times that you were in a totally impersonal setting with him, weren't you? I mean, not a formal banquet or a negotiating session. You're just meeting him as a person.
Well, of course, there were, yes, it was more relaxed. More relaxed than the other sessions had been.
What'd you talk about? Do you remember?
Oh, his hopes for the visit and the future and the relationship with the two countries. And it was not just an exclusive conversation.
Mm-hmm. Was Fongi there too?
Fongi was there. They would involve Kip Dovell in the conversations. She is a very, very good person, handles herself very well. And
immaculate, too.
Chides him in, of course. So that it was a general conversation rather than. Although I remember him as being full of excitement, he asked questions, but he didn't talk a very great deal as sometimes he had done. Well, even in dinners in Peking, he'd sometimes lapse into fairly long silences as though he was thinking of something far away. Then we got to Andrews, of course, with all the welcoming ceremonies. And we went to Blair House, and then we went back to Blair House at 6:40 to pick them up to go out to the Brzezinskis for that famous dinner of all the Chinese and the Americans who had been involved in the negotiating process. Really quite a dinner.
Yeah. Spig was like a little kid before. Yeah. I could imagine.
Yeah. You know, I must say that I was somewhat worried about the long ride and the jet lag problem and whether Dung would be too tired, because it was quite a ride out there, mm-hmm. quite a ride back. And of course, early the next morning, he had to be ready for the presidential meetings at the White House. But he took it all in stride. It was amazing.
Sterling performance. Yeah. That evening. We're at lunch, and we'll continue.